From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. 25 years after Peter Gabriel released the album So, Gabriel and the original touring band took it on the road. And the other night was closing night for the So Tour here in the U.S. It's the last time such monumental middle 80s songs like Sledgehammer and Don't Give Up are likely to be played for a long while. It happened in Fairfax, Virginia, in a sports arena called the Patriot Center. And despite the fact it was my first rock concert in a sports venue in decades, it was pretty fabulous. I went backstage just before soundcheck and had a conversation with Peter Gabriel. On this edition of All Songs Considered, Peter Gabriel plays DJ. A few notes for those too young to know or those too old to remember. Peter Gabriel's been such an influential figure in music for his use of visuals in both video and on stage. From his days in the great prog rock band Genesis beginning in the 1960s, Genesis mixed brilliant musicians with Gabriel's theatrics. His label Real World and the music festival WOMAD meant a great deal to non-Western artists. The label was such a great curator for music from all over the world. So we talk about some of these influences in this conversation, but I begin where I often begin in these DJ sessions. I ask him, what was the first music he bought with his own money?
Well, music was my mother's passion, and so...
Was she a player?
She played piano. Uh-huh. I mean, not professionally, but they, you know, Christmases were always full of all the members of the family singing and playing different instruments, and so it was quite a musical occasion. And on my dad's side, his sister had sung opera. So I didn't like everything there, but, you know, it was part of my life. And I think, but it was classical music for her, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, she had one or two sort of swinging things that she would play, but it was...
What would those swinging things be, you remember?
Buttons and Bows was uh-huh. one of them. Night and Day. I mean, it's sort of... classics yeah. from that period, really, I guess.
It's such a great period of music, of songwriting, of yeah. Lyricists and yeah. partnerships and so forth. And the first music that you can remember either buying with your own money or...
Well, I remember hearing the Beatles in the back of my parents' car when I guess I was 13 years old uh-huh. in 63, if that's when it came out, because I think I felt younger at the time, but it was way more radical sounding than... the Sex Pistols or punk ever was, because it was dirty and gritty, I mean, in a way that you encountered maybe only on blues records, but you never got to hear on sort of polite, popular radio.
It's hard for people to imagine that, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of times you play music like this now,
yeah.
it feels so innocent, right?
Yeah.
And so to place yourself into that time period in 1963 where, you know, you didn't hear people jangling around like that, right?
No, it was really revolutionary and very exciting. You know, I think I had the same feeling when I first heard Hey Joe. You know, it was...
Jimi Hendrix version?
Jimi Hendrix, yeah, okay. Hey yeah. Joe, sorry.
Yeah, that's fine.
Because, again, that was one of those things where you can picture where you were at that precise moment.
How about if we play just a little bit of You Wonder Please Please Me?
Sure.
Just for a second. At 13, did you have the urge to try to make music like this?
I knew that it was really exciting. I think by then I wanted to be a drummer. I think around 13 I bought my first musical instrument, which was a bass tom-tom, only because it was the only thing I could afford with my pocket money. It was £7, and I was so proud of it.
How big?
It wasn't probably 14 inches, but it was an old Premier tom-tom.
Driving your mom crazy with it?
Yep. And but it had, these were the days of real leather skins. That shows how old I am. But they have a really different sound. And even though they're a nightmare for drummers because they're always splitting, and there is something to the sound that you will never get out of a synthetic skin. And still now when I have, you know, and as a vegetarian, it brings up certain moral issues, I'm sure, but the... just from a sound point of view, you know, when I bought some of these Brazilian drums or Peruvian drums, which are probably my two favorite drums in my collection, there's a surdu, which is a huge monster of a thing. They're both natural skins, and the Peruvian drum, we call it hairy drum. Some of the hair's gone from, but it really has a different, more visceral, physical quality to it.
You are pretty passionate about that drum sound.
Yes, and I know I get very anal about, because, you know, drums were the first thing that really excited me. I was a drummer in a soul band and a jazz band.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, pretty bad.
Was there a lot of R&B that you liked back? So you would have been right in the heart of, well, for me and growing up in the States, it would have been Motown, but it's probably for you too, right?
Yeah, Motown, yeah. But Otis Redding was the king for me. Yeah. And so, you know, some of the Stax and that sort of classic R&B soul.
There's a lot of that Memphis sound, well, and Sledgehammer for sure, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, that was partly homage.
Oh, was it?
And you know, we tried to find whoever was left of the Memphis Horns, and Wayne Jackson sort of put a group together. And so that was part of the excitement of that session, was hearing all these Otis stories, because I managed to see Otis Redding, I think in 64, in Brixton in London, in the Ram Jam Club, which was a basement, and there were probably three white faces in the whole place. And it was still, to this day, my favorite ever gig.
Wow. Can you remember a song from that? Or just something from Otis that, you know, our show goes to people who are our age and sometimes right. 20, and you're surprised what they don't know. So let's turn people on to some Otis Redding.
Well, just try. I mean, Mr. Pitiful was one, Try a Little Tenderness. I mean, Otis Blue was probably my favorite album. So pretty much anything.
Let's see what I got.
What's it?
I've been loving you too long.
What's that?
Change is going to come.
Change is going to come. Yeah, let's do that. Because
right.
The way he bends the note is something that I've tried to do in many songs since then.
Is there any voice these days that you hear that does that for you? And it's not to say there aren't great singers, but maybe it's just growing up on it, but it really does hit.
Well, to me, what is magical about that is you've got what I would call sort of soft voices and hard voices. And here's a voice that has got both those qualities. It's got incredible warmth, pain, love, you know, and... you know, I've said it about Yusu sometimes, and it's a different, very
Yusu
different...
Yusu Endor, yeah, for people who don't
know. Yusu Endor, sorry, very different kettle of fish. But this feeling that the sun then comes out when they start singing, you know, it's a... you just felt your heart being opened when you're in his presence. And it's Yeah, I still feel all that emotion when I hear it. And, I mean, say, you know, someone like Springsteen, who has incredible energy as a performer, if you can imagine that times something...
You
start to get near Otis, because he'd stop it and he'd be very still sometimes, but when he was on, it was just like a factory of energy, love, and passion.
And 45 years later, we're talking about him. I mean, and he passed so young. He's 60 in 1967.
Right.
Is when died in a plane crash, and the, I guess the power of what he did really speaks that we're even thinking about that guy still.
Yeah.
So we did something, I wouldn't have thought you'd pick the Beatles and not, I mean, sort of how could you, in some ways, they were so important to everybody at that age.
And, yeah, because they, if you weren't there, you don't sort of get what they were doing to the world. The world was sort of locked up, repressed, 50s, and there was this sense that young people were coming of age. It was, we were inheriting the world, and I don't think from the... Many years ago, there'd ever been a moment where sort of mass communication and culture collided in such a way to thrust a generation into the limelight as happened in the 60s. And I know people are very bored about people banging on about the 60s,
right.
But there was something unique about it. It was so exciting to be a Beatle fan then. And you know, yes, we all had lots of other influences and interests, but that was the core of where it was happening, and it was really good music. I mean, you know, so much now, the mainstream is not necessarily where the great music is, but then it was.
But there is a lot of great music.
There is always.
Undeniably, right?
No, there's always great music and great musicians out there. So, and I don't, you know, I love good pop music too. I never put that down. I started off trying to write pop songs, and I still respect people who do. It's something I'm still passionate about, is to try and get a songwriters festival together where you mix sort of Mary Poppins along with Nine Inch Nails, and it's because it's all music, you know. And is it Basie who said that there's only two types of music, good and bad?
Yeah.
And you know, that rings true for me, and let's celebrate the good. And also the art of songwriting, because although there are people who are passionate about it, I think it needs to be supported and praised and celebrated, because it would be a shame for young people just to get excited by the beats and the sounds and not get the full flavor of what they can do with words and melodies and harmonies.
Thinking of Count Basie, and one of the things that Count Basie could music, bad music. I know one of the artists who you really love as a singer is Nina Simone, and a great song that I saw on a list of yours was I Put a Spell on You.
Yeah, that again was one of those things where I remember the room I was in at school when I first heard that coming out of the radio on Radio Luxembourg, and it just stank of human passion. And the way she does this duet with the saxophone has... again, inspired me in many things since then.
I put a spell on you because you're mine. You're mine.
I think that's the the anthem for unrequited love.
That's beautiful. So on the this new record, So. New record, So, yes, of course. Sure. On the 25th anniversary of it. Some interesting stuff going on. There's live from, Athens?
Yeah, we did the video, which
is a DVD. There's a remaster of the record. Yeah. And then there's these things that you call them DNA?
Yeah.
Which sort of the strands of the song is how I interpreted that. Can I play a little bit of Red Rain? And let me play the regular version first, so people who don't know the song know it. And then let's just sort of go back and just talk about...
Pull it to pieces.
Yeah. First of all, the drum sound, right? We talked about this just a moment ago. I don't guess there's any leather here, but
no, there isn't there, but there's I mean, because I'm so anal about drummers and drums, you know, we do have some the best drummers. You know, I'm very, very lucky.
And who's that drummer?
That's mainly Manu, but sometimes, you know, there may be, I think, a bit of Stuart Copeland's hi-hat. I mean, and I, you know, I cut up some of the performances and glued bits from different players because we had Jerry Marotta doing a lot of tracks and there's a good amount of him on some of the tracks, but Manu principally on that record, but little bits of Stuart. I've worked with so many brilliant drummers, Steve Gadd, Billy Cobham, and it's one of the perks of the job for me is that I get to work with these amazing players.
And the sound itself, so the playing is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, the sound, yes.
But you are going after something that it snaps so well.
Yeah. Well, I also...
But it's also very musical.
Yeah, I think...
Do you tune drums? Do you...
Well, I love tune drums. And I think Jazz on a Summer's Day, a long time ago, the Chico Hamilton, they had these very obviously tuned drums. And I thought, that's interesting, you know, playing melodies with drums. Mm-hmm. And I've been fascinated with that ever since. And Manu certainly is someone who's a sort of compositional player who improvises in a very musical way. And we do try and get the drums tuned.
And do you tune them to a key on a keyboard?
It depends. You know, sometimes it'll be related to the track. First of all, the player will tune their own stuff. And if it sounds great, we don't mess with it. But... Some drums have sort of voices, if you like, and if they're sort of speaking in that way, so, like the Sodu, for instance, or this Hairy drum, when we use them, which wasn't on this track, but they will always be tuned to the pitch of the key. So I think it is another way of getting information. And the other thing, you know, we looked at is we had this one record, not this one, where we just didn't use cymbals at all. And that cleared up the high frequencies because... Sometimes you need to think in composition of every bass note you use is a big fat mother, you know, it takes a lot of space. And if you can do some of the same musical jobs up high.
That's interesting. So that's why some of that there's that clarity at the top of the drum, that ring out that happens. There's room for it now because the cymbals aren't there.
So we try and get the sort of lot of high information. I mean, but in this case, there are cymbals, but it's But that's just one idea. Mm-hmm. And also, I had Daniel Lanois and Kevin Killen as producer and engineer, who were both brilliant in their
really
fields.
Are.
So everything sounded good. And Dan is also good at visualizing stuff. So as well as me having an idea of where I wanted to go and what I wanted to sound like, he does as well.
So I'll play some of the basics, just a little bit of the DNA strand of Red Rain.
Yeah, maybe I should explain too, because we keep a recording device of some sort on. It used to be cassette players, then DAT players, and
oh my God, you must have warehouses.
We have warehouses of these things, and I would recommend that to anyone composing, because it's very cheap in this digital world to keep everything recorded. But also have a code track or some sort of button or pedal that you can click live when something interesting happens, and then you won't have to go through all the crap. But anyway, it meant that we could come back, and we couldn't find everything, but we found quite a few things, often on cassette, from these sessions. And there were moments, when a certain melody was discovered or rhythm that later led eventually to the final song.
So I'll play just a touch of this.
And they're not always very good.
Yeah, I think you might wince at your voice in this one, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe.
No.
You tell me.
No. There's definitely a few real bummers. So those were two separate occasions spliced together.
And do you mostly write on piano? It seems like this is a song written on piano.
Yeah.
Is that true, often for you?
Yeah, often. And then a drum machine will often be a key part of it, that I need to be inspired by the rhythm. And I work particularly at the beginning, long and hard, trying to find grooves don't seem the same as everyone else's grooves that I'm listening to.
You recently did a covers record called Scratch My Back, and when I saw the track list before I heard it, I expected, is it going to be monumental? Is it going to be huge? And then listening to them, you had this beautiful surprise for all of us. That's how I looked at it. They were very spare.
Yeah.
There were some stark pulsating strings, some nice swelling horns and strings. How did you approach this? I mean, that Boy in a Bubble, very, very slow. It put a spotlight on all the lyrics to these songs, for sure, and the heart, the melody of these songs, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was from a songwriter's perspective, and I was working with a wonderful arranger, John Metcalf, too. So the idea was to try and sort of strip them back to what they had begun as. And, I mean, the Paul Simon was probably the most interesting in the sense that it was the most different from where it had started, which was this up-tempo Graceland track that a lot of people loved. And, we emptied it right out, took away every ounce of African blood. And what was left, was another miserable white man song.
But when that line comes, these are the days of miracle and wonder, don't cry, baby, don't cry. It was even more poignant than it was in the original song, at least I thought so.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road. There was a bright light, a shattering of shop windows. The bomb in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way
way we look to a song, the way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracles and wonder. Don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry.
He's such a great writer. You know, few there are writers who are extremely gifted musically. You know, you could say a sort of Brian Wilson person or someone who's extremely gifted lyrically, like Leonard Cohen. Mm. And but rarely do you find someone who's sort of balanced in their talent.
The way Paul Simon is. Yeah. I'm here at the Patriot Center here in Fairfax, Virginia, right. And I'm going to see your show tonight. You're going to do so. I'm sure you're going to do an awful lot more. What's exciting you making music? You did a beautiful record with amazing string arrangements. Again, there were strings on the covers record. Is that seem to be the way you're working these days?
No, I think I'll stay away from orchestra on the next thing, probably. And in fact, what we do on this show is we have three parts. So the first part is more like it would be in rehearsal. It actually starts with an unfinished song, which doesn't yet have a lyric. And we keep the house lights on, and it's acoustic or semi-acoustic instruments. And we do sort of four or five numbers like that. And then the second chunk, I think of it as sort of starter, main course, and dessert.
Uh-huh.
And the main course is more sort of electronic, as you know, also includes a song like Family in the Fishing Net, which is not one of the most sort of easy songs for my audience. But anyway, if they get through that section, then they get to the dessert, and that's the So album from start to finish.
Could you just rattle off some of the instrumentation that's on stage or any of the people we might know?
Well, it is, in fact, the band that took that record out to the world 25, 26 years ago, which is with Tony Levin.
Oh, my God, how great.
David Sanchez, Manu Katché on the drums, and David Rhodes on guitar. And then we have these great girl singers. We were going to have Anna Brune, as with the orchestral tour, but she got sick, sadly. But the lady who stepped in, Jenny Abrahamson, who was working with Anna, is fantastic. And she's also working with a talented cello player, songwriter also called Linnea Olsen. So there's an endless supply of talented Scandinavians.
It's really exciting. So just choose me a cut from So that I should go out on.
Oh, I think it probably is In Your Eyes.
Okay.
Because that's it's got a mixture of emotions, and it's still, and you can still dance to it.
Thanks so much for doing this.
Well,
thanks, Peter.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Bob.
Cheers. Peter Gabriel. This version is from the So Remasters. You can find the 25th anniversary box set. It's out now. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
Of all the fruitless soldiers, oh, I Of all the fruitless searches.